Lynn Rossetto Casper with the Splendid Table. Going behind the scenes of one of the great cooking schools of Europe to take a look at life in the French countryside. Anne Willen runs La Varenne out of her chateau in one of the little-known gems of France, the Burgundy region. Jane and Michael Stern are at Al's Place, where the owners are Italian, but they serve steak, there's always peanut butter and jelly on the table, and the town is Chinese. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner hunts down kitchen antiques. Wine expert Joshua Wesson has great rosés for summer, and we have a seafood alert. All this and your calls coming up on the Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. If your market is like ours, everywhere you look, there are fresh pulled beets. Now, I think growing beets is a real roll of the dice for farmers because this is not a vegetable we all know and love. Think about it. How many people get wistful and dreamy, longing for that first great beet of summer? But you know, beets are really good eating. Okay, so they're not tomatoes and they're not sweet corn, but they are sweet, and they're really easy to prepare. You can do sexy things with beets. At least I think so. The trick to buying beets is that the top should be on and they should look fresh. No wilting. And by the way, you can cook beet greens just the way you would cook chard. Now, the beets don't have to be huge, and don't ignore the red and orange beets. For my money, they often don't taste quite as good as the old-fashioned purple ones, but they're pretty on a plate. Then there's the cooking question. Now, first you should know you don't have to cook beets at all. You could shred them and then do a sweet-sour marinade, you know, like mixing concentrated orange juice with vinegar, diced onion, some fresh minced ginger. And you could serve that just as it is as a salad. You could put it on top of a green salad, or you could use it instead of ketchup on top of a hamburger. When it comes to cooking beets, hands down the best way is roasting. They get even sweeter, none of their vitamins get lost in the cooking water, they're easier to peel after roasting, and roasted beets keep in the fridge for about a week with absolutely no problem. So to roast beets, you wash them, trim away the stalk and the root end, and then you wrap them in foil. Roast them at about 400 degrees for maybe an hour, or until you can easily pierce the beet with a knife. Once you cool them down, you can peel them without staining your hands by either using rubber gloves or rub the beets in paper towels. Now, if you think you'd like your roasted beets warmed up, just cut them into wedges and sauté them quickly in butter with some grated lemon zest. That little nip of tartness keeps them from being too sweet. Now, obviously, you'll season this with salt and pepper. Then you can serve the sautéed beets with grilled seafood or chicken, or eat them on their own with a green salad and some homemade cornbread. Roasted beets that you've sliced and sprinkled with Spanish sherry vinegar and good olive oil are really delicious. You could gussy that up by sprinkling the beets with fresh mint and some coriander leaves and a mince of medium-hot chilies. Beets, green beans, and walnuts have a real liking for each other, and usually the beans and the beets are in their prime at the same time. Now, all you have to do is roast the beets, boil your green beans, and to keep the beans from getting stained, mix everything together just before serving. You could do the old, you know, vinegar, oil, herb dressing, but what I like to do is to mix some fresh grated horseradish with a little vinegar, and then mix it with sour cream. Salt and pepper the beans and the beets. Toss it with the cream. Now, yes, everything is going to turn pink eventually, but then top everything with some walnuts. This is really good eating. Now, you can't think beets without thinking borscht, that great Russian classic. There's no one recipe for the soup, but cold borscht is a delicious one-dish meal for summer nights. I love borscht because it uses just about every vegetable you can find, including some you may never have tried before. Here's what I mean. Dice up equal amounts of raw beets, tomatoes, and onions. Then dice up half that amount each of potatoes, cabbage, kohlrabi, and celery root. Now, if you don't know what these last two are, just ask in the farmer's market. Add a tart chopped up apple, lots of black pepper and garlic, some allspice, and some vinegar. And of course, you're going to need some broth or water to cover. Simmer everything 2 hours, taste it for seasoning, and then cool it down. Serve it chilled, and as it goes to the table, drop on each bowl lots of chopped fresh dill, a dollop of sour cream or yogurt, and give everybody a big wedge of lemon to squeeze over the borscht. Talk about great food. Chilled borscht for a summer night, a great beet classic. So try some beets this week and tune in again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where you'll find an exclusive selection of Corningware bakeware, including the classic French white line. Corningware can go from the freezer to the oven to the dinner table. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, today we're talking with Ann Willen. You may know Ann's name from the many cookbooks she's done or from her cooking school, La Varenne, which she runs in her chateau in France. This reminds me of that old saying, it's a tough job, but somebody has to do it. Well, Ann is going to tell us what it's really like living in a huge, old, rambling chateau in the middle of the French countryside. The chateau is located in a region that most travelers ignore. It's called Burgundy, and it's a gorgeous part of France. Ann has an insider's take. Our wine maverick, Joshua Wesson, maintains rosés aren't for sissies anymore, and he's got some good picks for around $10 a bottle. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner always has her own personal take on how to fine-tune our kitchens for top performance. She's been checking out antique kitchen tools that still work for us today. We have a seafood alert from California's Monterey Bay Aquarium. They serve seafood in their cafeteria, so the scientists there keep tabs on which fish are endangered and which are plentiful. It kind of smacks of eating your associates for dinner. Well, in the second half of the show, we're going to open the lines for your calls, as we always do. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with that road food duo, Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, you're not going to believe the name of the restaurant we found in Locke, California. It is officially named Al the Wop.
You're kidding.
No, that is painted on the door. It's been known that way since 1934. The people that ran it then, the people that run it now are Italians, and they're just delighted to be called Al the Wop. Makes me cringe, and I'm kind of uncomfortable with it, but that's how everybody knows this place. And, you know, we are not ones to let a politically incorrect name stop us from getting some really delicious food. So.
See, but you have to step back. The fact that Al the Wop is in an all-Chinese town in California makes it even weirder. Locke, California looks like an old ghost town. It's a completely all Chinese town dating back to the gold rush. And Al's place has been there since 1934 when Al Adami, who was fresh out of prison as a convicted bootlegger, moved into Li Bing's chop suey joint and opened up the only non-Chinese restaurant in town. So today when you go to Al the Wop's to eat, you have your choice of sitting in the front room or in the Tong dining room and back. I like that this is cross-cultural.
Now,
this is
add to the mix, when you sit in the Tong dining room, what the main thing on the menu is steak and French fries.
Or great, great hamburgers.
Great hamburgers.
Those old Italian specialties.
Yeah.
Right. There's nothing Italian served here.
And the hamburgers, by the way, are served on French bread, just to add to the mix.
With peanut butter.
With peanut
butter. And
there's
marmalade.
A jar of peanut butter on every table. The legend is that some crop doctor once came in and wanted to trade peanut butter for a sandwich, and somehow the peanut butter got to be a thing there. Nobody knows what to do with the peanut butter, but it's on every table now.
Well, sort of like, this is a restaurant that nobody quite knows what to do with the restaurant, with the town that the restaurant's in, with anything about it, except if you want a taste of California that is not cutting edge, that is not modern, that is not, you know, high tech or .com.
Mm-hmm.
Luck California and Al's is probably as far going back in time as you can.
So tell me specifically, what does the food at Al's taste like?
Okay, actually,
it's actually wonderful.
What the best thing to get, in my opinion, is the steak sandwich, which, in keeping with Al's, is not really a sandwich at all. What it is a steak on a plate with a couple of pieces of really wonderful grilled crisp Italian bread with lettuce, tomato, onions, pickle, and olives all piled up on the side. So you kind of make your own sandwich out of these ingredients. It's a delicious grilled steak. In fact, you hear the steaks grilling from the Tong dining room because the kitchen is right adjacent.
And in addition to the peanut butter and marmalade with the steak sandwich, you're given horseradish and a dish of minced garlic to put on it.
Now, those are good. And if I can add one more really peculiar thing to the story of Al's, in the front room, the bar room, look upwards and you notice that the ceiling is completely plastered with dollar bills.
Dusty, old, dirty dollar bills.
Well, not only a year old, because they harvest the dollar bills every year.
How do they get there?
Well, this is what we asked the bartender. How do those dollar bills get up stuck on the ceiling? The bartender said it will cost you a dollar to find out. So we gave him a dollar, and he has some fancy way we didn't see. It was sort of sleight of hand. He wraps the dollar around a silver dollar. Of course, this is a folding dollar we gave him. He wraps it around a silver dollar and a tack and flips it upward, and the dollar somehow sticks to the ceiling with the tack. And he said, what we do is every year, once a year in February, we harvest the dollars and have a big town-wide liver and onions feed.
I like this. Okay, so it's, I'm going to call it Al's Place. I just can't do the other. And it's in Locke, California.
It's on Main Street in Locke. And Locke
is about, Main Street is the only street in Locke, so you can find it easily.
Right. All of Locke, California is about 200 feet long, so you will not have any problem finding it. And it's open for lunch and for dinner.
Thank you, guys.
You're welcome.
Happy eating.
Now, woman, I'm leaving.
Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. Every week you can hear them here on The Splendid Table, and every week you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is always looking for good wine for little money. He's the president of Best Sellers Wine Shops, and he's a regular here at The Splendid Table. Joshua, good to have you back.
It's good to be had anywhere.
Josh,
I'll do it right here with you.
You're on. I want to talk about rosés because they are not for sissies anymore. You know, I mean, they've become quite credible. So tell me about what your picks would be for some really good rosés.
Well, I'm glad you brought up rosé because I happen to be a pink freak. And I don't mean that in the way I dress. I mean, it's just something that's part of my life in the summertime. You open my refrigerator and you'll see half the wines in there blushing with some variation of pink or rosé. And that's because in many ways rosé is the quintessential warm weather wine. And rosés are made everywhere that people make red wines. They're just incompletely made reds. Some people think they're actually pink grapes that people pick, but they're not. They're just incompletely made red wines. They do make pink Catawba. That actually comes from a pink grape, but other than that, and that'll cause point mutations in most genes, we're talking about partially made red wines. And I think that's one reason why they don't get the respect they deserve, is because people say, well, they're half made reds. They can't be really good wines. But nothing could be further from the truth. On a summer day, as the sun is setting and you have a beautiful glass of Provençal rosé or a rosé of Pinot Noir, and all is good with the world.
But now, what do you mean by an incompletely made red? Exactly how do you make rosé?
Well, if you ever peel back the skin of a red grape, you notice that the flesh is green. And if you squeeze a red grape, the first trickles of juice that come out are green in color. Mm-hmm. In order to make a green juice turn red, you've got to let the skin of the grape stay in contact with that green juice for a period of time, usually days, sometimes weeks. And if you want to make a rosé, all you do if you're a winemaker is let the skin of the red grape stay in contact with that green juice for a few hours or a day at the most, and then it'll just blush it a little bit. Instead of turning it red, it'll turn pink.
And it gives it some of the character of a red wine.
Right. But okay. Think of all the things that you don't get. You don't get the tannin if you don't let the skin stay in contact with the juice. You don't get this tremendous concentration of flavor, which is frankly something that you don't want on a warm summer day. You don't want to drink a big, rich, tannic red wine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good substitute for white wine. In fact, rosés are red wines that think that they're white, and that's why they're so flexible at the dinner table. They're great with anything that comes out of a picnic basket, and they're great for sipping all in their lonesome.
Okay, now I want you to name some names. Give us some ideas of what to look for.
You know, if you're a red wine lover, then you've had rosés from all over the world, and I've picked three that come from different places, and they're wildly different in style, but they're all equally delicious. Navarin rosés are very, very popular in Spain, and my favorite amongst the bunch this year. And I should say, before we get into the specific wines, that you should never drink a rosé more than 2 years from the vintage, and it's best to drink it just 1 year off the vintage. So all these wines are 1999s, and the fresher, the better, because rosés don't improve. Unlike red wines, they don't improve in the bottle.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Vega Sindoa, VEGA SINDOA, wonderful Navarin blend, not terribly far from Barcelona, made from Grenache, or what they call Garnacha there, and Tempranillo, and it is just everything you could ever want in a dry yet fruity rosé.
What kind of pricing are we looking at here?
All these wines are under $10. Because rosé is being incompletely made reds are never taken too seriously when it comes to pricing, except for one rosé from Provence. It's sort of the grandma or granddaddy. I don't know what the gender is, but it's called Domaine Haute. And people will recognize it because it comes in a bottle that looks like a bowling pin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually a little bit orange in color, meaning that it's too old since nobody bought it because it costs so much money. Who would spend $20 on a rosé? But it's from Bandol, and I find it wildly overpriced and deeply unsatisfying, which is why the next wine that I recommend is an antidote to Domaine Haute. It's called Chateau Routas, R-O-U-T-A-S, and it's made not terribly far from Bandol in Provence. Same mélange of grapes. It's got Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre, non-fat dry milk, players to be named later. They sort of throw everything in the mix there.
Right, okay.
But it is... it's drier than the Vega Sindoa from Navarra, from Spain, that I mentioned. And it's a little bit crisper and cleaner. And they drink it with bouillabaisse all the time. And it's just a brilliant summer white, especially for fish dishes.
Mm.
And the third rosé that I had in mind, a little bit richer than the other two, a little bit more serious, but just by one tick of the clock. And it's from California. It's made by Sanford, a producer in California known for making Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. But they happen to make a rosé from Pinot Noir, which is stunning. And if you close your eyes and smell this wine, you'd swear it was a Pinot Noir, a red wine. But in fact, you taste it, and it's got 1 foot in the red wine world, 1 foot in the white wine world, brings the best of both together, and you know, I can't think of a greater equalizer, a Colt 45, a wine that'll go with just about anything. And not the screw top Colt 45. We're talking about the six shooter.
I understand. You know,
just for those listeners who might not be aware of the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic wines, all $10 or less, all 1999s. Drink them and, you know, move on. That's the way I say.
Josh, thank you for the primer.
My pleasure.
Obsession. Yeah, think it's not even a question. Think on the lips of your lover. Cause think it's the love you discover.
else in public radio are you going to hear Aerosmith? Joshua Wesson is creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops, and you can get Josh's rosé picks on our website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Ann Willen takes us behind the scenes of a chateau cooking school. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner prowls for antique tools. And, of course, we'll take your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Rosetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and your family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. French food authority Ann Willen seems to lead a charmed life. Her cookbooks are read around the world. Her TV series won awards. And she opened the first cooking school in Paris to cater to Americans. It was called La Varenne. Then she moved the school to her new home, a chateau in the French countryside. Tough life, right? Well, certainly an enviable one. Anne's new book is From My Chateau Kitchen. It tells what it's like to live in a French chateau. Something most of us can only dream about. Anne, welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, Anne, how long have you had Chateau Dufay?
Well, it's nearly 20 years, and it's just flown past.
Now, look, when we think of living in a chateau, most of us think, quite frankly, of a magnificent old house, beautiful land, servants, and maybe you're stretched out on a chaise saying, peel me a grape. So, is this what it's like?
No. We wondered. I mean, when we fell in love with it, we were crazy. We saw it, and a week later, we'd made an offer on it, and a week later, we'd been accepted. And then we thought, what on earth are we letting ourselves in for? And indeed, we thought, oh, well, life on the chaise long in the sun. And there is a bit of that. Of course there is. It's the most beautiful place. It's lovely weather. We have this magnificent view from the terrace. Friends are very keen on coming to visit. But there are lots of downsides. It's a lot of responsibility. You have to keep things going. The electricity goes off, it sometimes seems, at the drop of a hat. Classic at Christmas, the biggest storm of the century hit on December the 26th, and we were having a great big party for the millennium, and possibly 200 trees came down in the forest, the electricity went off, a bit of the roof blew off, all sorts of things. So it's an adventure, constant adventure.
How big is the chateau?
It's, well, you lose count because what counts as a room? But it probably has 16 bedrooms, and it has three separate houses that we now rent out that are kind of surround us on the courtyard.
Where exactly is the chateau?
We're about an hour and a half south of Paris.
So is this the area called Burgundy?
Absolutely. Just. But it's very Burgundian in the sense that the chateau looks very Burgundian, and we have wonderful, wonderful food and produce. And Burgundian snails roam the woods, and it really is very, very traditional.
What is Burgundy like? I mean, this is a region a lot of people don't know about.
It's very historic. The Dukes of Burgundy were, in their heyday in the 1300s, more powerful than the kings of France, and they ruled north from Dijon right up to the Channel. They were closely associated with Spain. They ruled the spice trade, so that there are traditional dishes that are full of spices. They spent their money on, or quite a lot of it, building the most beautiful buildings that have survived until now. And so you have these wonderful abbeys and hospices, of which the Hospice de Beaune is the most famous, beautiful cathedrals, monasteries, and of course the monks love good food. And they made quantities of wine, and they ate very well, and everybody still eats extraordinarily well in Burgundy.
Give me an idea of what is typical Burgundian food.
Well, you know, when we first moved there, I wondered what it was like, because one hears there's such good food in Burgundy, and you can't kind of put your finger on it. And it's really that there are extraordinarily good ingredients. So Charolais cattle are Burgundian, and now they are breeding cattle all over the world because it's fashionable lean beef, and they're great big animals and very docile, so they're easy to manage. The most famous chickens in the world are Burgundian, the breast chickens that now one hears all about. And the lovely river fish, which of course isn't as good as it used to be, but he's coming back. Crayfish and pike and perch and all of those sort of things. But basically, really, really good fruits and vegetables. There's this lovely old man called Monsieur Mulebert, who's 80 this year, and who still grows things in the old way and has taught me an awful lot about growing things.
What about the people? You must work with the local people, the local food people,
yes,
running a school.
Yes, we do. Yes. The local people are still there. They haven't moved to Paris because they love being in the countryside and living off the land. And you get people like old Mulebert, who may brews his own Calvados, presses his own cider, lives off the vegetables in the garden, raises chickens and rabbits and ducks and eggs and so on. In the market, and we have a wonderful flourishing market every Saturday 4 miles away, you get the cheese producers and the watercress lady and the raw milk people and the sausage people and Madame Durville, who raises chickens and everything to do with poultry. There's a foie gras lady now. And, there are about 70 different sellers, of which about half grow only local produce.
Now, Anne, you run a business in your home. You have Laveraine Cooking School at the Chateau. When does that happen, and how many people? Are they living with you at the Chateau?
Yes, people come. It's a kind of country house party. And we give classes at the good months of the year, June and July. And we try to show people what I've been talking about, what goes on in the countryside, the beautiful places, the great produce. We bring it back to the Chateau, we cook it in the kitchen, we explore local recipes, we taste local wines, the cheese man comes to talk about it, and we just kind of generally get immersed in everything that's important.
Like good food.
And thank you, Lynn. It was lovely to talk to you and to talk about things that we both love.
Anne Willen is author of From My Chateau Kitchen. You can get a copy of a recipe she collected from one of her favorite pastry chefs. It's Patrick Gautier's soft-centered warm chocolate cakes. You can get the recipe two ways. Either mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or go to our website at splendidtable.org. Deborah Krasner is my kind of kitchen designer. She knows food and she likes to cook. Deborah, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Deborah, garage sales and all kinds of flea markets are starting to dot the landscape. Is there stuff there that we should be looking for?
There are treasures, things that are better than anything you can buy now, or that you can buy now, but they're much less expensive. For instance, potato mashers, those things with handles and heavy wire and then a series of S-shaped loops that you pound.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the best way to mash potatoes. It's better than anything except a potato ricer, which is another tool that you can look for in garage sales. And you know what a potato ricer looks like? They're sort of like a giant garlic press.
They're like a cylinder and they have holes in the bottom.
That's right. And you just squeeze down the top handle onto the bottom handle, and it mashes your potatoes for you. So those are great tools to look for. And then the little tools that you don't think you need, but when you have them, you use them more than you ever thought possible, like a cherry pitter or an olive pitter, both of which are things that look like large dental tools. And then, you know, apple corers and slicers, those things that look like wagon wheels that you put on top of an apple and push down. The ones that used to be made are much sturdier in general than the ones you can buy today. So look for those. You're not going to pay more than a dollar for them, and they're fabulous. And then there are tools that are just great luxury tools that you might not be able to have otherwise, like copper pots and pans are frequently at flea markets and garage sales, and they're often expensive, but much less expensive than they would be if you were buying them new. And the reason that they're sold usually is that they need to be retinned on the interior. But it seems that getting things retinned, although pricey, is not hard to do. You can do it by mail. There are numerous places all over the country that do it. And you just send them your copper pot, it comes back looking like new.
Huh.
Other things that are wonderful and old are things like mallets for pounding chicken breasts. And you want to get the kind that don't have teeth, the flat kind.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite tool is a tool that was told... I learned about it from a 77-year-old friend who uses it every fall when she's making jellies. And she gave me a whole bushel of quinces, those very hard apple-like fruits.
Oh, yeah.
And she lent me this tool, and it's called a Mehulisu Steam Cooker Juice Extractor. And what it is a series of stainless steel pots. The bottom holds water. The middle one has another pot with a surgical tube coming out of it and a spigot.
Huh.
And the top part is a colander and a cover. And you put water in the bottom. You leave the center one empty, and you put the fruit in the top. And it steams the fruit and cooks it. The juice drips down into this middle container and comes out the spigot into your jelly jar, ready to be canned either as juice or cooked down into jelly. And it is the most efficient, brilliant design. So I got on the phone to the importer. He has a website. It's www.podunk.com. And I spoke to this man, and he said, an old lady told you about this, right? And I said, how did you know? And he said, because all my customers are old ladies. He said, everybody has been using this thing for 40 or 50 years. And now I get calls saying I've been using it for 45 years, and I need a new surgical tube.
And that's all that goes. Where is it made?
It's made in Finland. and it costs $129, and it's worth it. It's just extraordinary because in addition to extracting fruit juice without having to peel and core and do all the other things,
right,
like run it through a jelly bag, you can cook a whole meal in it. You can steam corn and vegetables in it. You can cook in it in lots of different ways, and you can use the different sections for different things so that the bottom section can be your every night pasta pot if you want.
Tell me what the name is again.
Well, it's a Finnish name. So it's Mehu, M-E-H-U, dash Liisu, L-I-I-S-A.
Deborah, I am off to the garage sale. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner consults with clients across the country from her studio in Vermont. She's author of Kitchens for Cooks.
The service I can render, tell the one who loves you only, I can't be so warm and tender, call me, don't be afraid, you can call me, baby.
It is time to go to the phones. We've opened the lines for your calls. Call us. 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Anything you want to talk about, I'll give it a try. Let's get right to the lines. We have Bard on the line. Hey, Bard, what's on your mind?
Well, now that tomatoes and cucumbers and mint and parsley are coming in, we think of tabbouleh. But every time we try and make tabbouleh, the vulgar either comes out like cream of wheat or like bird gravel.
And what an attractive image, Bard.
Well,
bird gravel.
It's either too gummy or it's you know, to break your teeth. So I want to know how to prepare vulgar so you can make tabbouleh.
Okay, well, now vulgar is wheat, and the key to this, you probably know this, because you know tabbouleh is essentially a salad of bulgur and parsley and all of those ingredients you talked about, and a lot of people make it different ways, but it's really, I love it in the summer. Well, what it really is it's cooked whole wheat grains or kernels that are then dried and then they're cracked.
Uh-huh.
And so all you're really doing with this stuff is rehydrating it.
Right.
So the key generally is how much liquid you add to the wheat. And usually it works out to being something like 1 cup of bulgur to 1 3/4 cups of water.
Hot or cold?
Hot, boiling, if possible.
And you don't cook it, right?
No, some people do. Some people simmer it.
Well, we've had some success occasionally, but sometimes we can't ever recreate it.
All right. Well, yeah, that's always a problem with success, isn't it? I mean, okay. So the thing here is, are you using, there are different, you know, coarseness of this grain. Are you using very coarse or fine?
I think we used fine.
Use fine. Usually fine just needs soaking. About 15 minutes or until you get it exactly where you want it. You know what some people do in the Middle East? They soak it in the boiling water, and when they get it tender enough, they drain it and they just spread it out on a towel to absorb the excess moisture so you don't get mush.
We tried that. We tried when it gets wet, we throw it on a towel.
Right.
And then you roll up the towel and squeeze it. Mm-hmm. Then it's horrible to try and scrape it off the towel.
Hey, I didn't say this was easy. No, but seriously, I think if you cut down on the water, you're going to be there. I think that's the problem you have. And it's that balance of 1 to 1 3/4 is just about right.
Okay.
Okay, give that a try. And the only other thing I can think of, you're not using any acids. Are you, like, throwing in vinegar or lemon when you're soaking it?
No, not when we soak it, but
right.
Of course you put lemon and olive oil and stuff in it when you're making
that's later.
The salad.
Yeah, that's later. No, because sometimes with some starches, if you try to cook them in anything or you know, fluff them in anything that has a lot of acid, sometimes that cuts back on the process. But don't worry about that. Just try that proportion. See how it works for you.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Well, thank you.
Okay, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Our visit with Anne Willen started me thinking about French food. So today's trivia question is,
what makes Dijon mustard Dijon mustard? We'll have that answer in a moment, and we'll get back to your calls. So get to the phones. The number's 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. It's open lines for your calls this hour at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. It was about mustard, and the question was, what makes Dijon mustard Dijon mustard? Now, you can't just rent a basement in the town of Dijon and start making mustard. Dijon mustard has to have one specific ingredient. It has to be made with black mustard seeds. Not yellow ones, not brown ones, but the most spicy and pungent mustard seed, the black kind. Then there's this fancy trick. You have to remove the dark outer coating of the seed so that the mustard doesn't look like it's made with black mustard seed at all. Another ingredient that's used in Dijon and all over France is the grape, at least in one form or another, like wine vinegar or wine or verjuice. Now, verjuice is the juice of unripe grapes. Before you think, how original of the French to come up with a way to even use sour grapes, you should know that they stole verjuice from the Romans. Now, the Romans settled all over France long before anyone even knew how to pronounce Dijon. Now, Anne Willen has an important tip for cooking with mustard. You should never overheat it because heat kills off the enzymes that give mustard much of its goodness. So always stir mustard into a sauce at the end of cooking. This is why rubbing mustard into that piece of meat and then grilling it never tastes as good as you think it should. Well, of course, you can sidestep this whole heat question by using Dijon mustard in a cold sauce, like I like to do with potato salad or cold chicken. All you do is take some cold chicken or some potatoes and dress it with a blend of Dijon mustard, mayonnaise, fresh dill, red onion, and a dash of Tabasco. Okay, let's get back to the phones. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up. We have Kathleen calling. So, Kathleen, what's on your mind?
We have this gorgeous 10-pound lamb leg, and I have this great idea for a party that would probably knock the stockings off of a few people. And by stockings, I mean a Renaissance-style party, whereas everyone shows up in traditional garb, and this lamb leg becomes the entertainment. But I think I may be a bit limited in the equipment that I have in order to do so. Perhaps I'm mistaken, but I always thought that they would either roast or grill or over the fire, do it very slowly.
That's right.
And since I don't have any way to do that, I have a small grill and a gas oven.
Well, you could do a 10-pound leg of lamb in an oven.
Mm-hmm.
You could do that.
But would that be as fun?
Well, already, you know, Kathleen, I cannot imagine being, just from the sound of you, boy, I can't imagine being bored at a party at your house. But I love the idea of the Renaissance, and you're asking everybody to show up in costume?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think this is great. Of course, you're talking, you know, I'm the Renaissance queen of the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there is no period I enjoy more. than that period.
That's
and
wonderful.
I think what you could do with the leg of lamb, you could do a slow roast on the grill.
Mm-hmm.
But the other great thing about the Renaissance is you've got all these great flavors to play with. And I trust you, trust me rather, when I get done with you, your leg of lamb will definitely be a talking point.
Mm.
This is what you're going to do with your leg of lamb.
Okay.
All right? Follow me on this one. Because
gotcha.
Sweet and savory was a big deal then in the same dish. You're going to take off all the fat.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to make deep slits in the lamb.
Garlic.
Oh, yeah, well, more than that. Okay. You're going to pound, however you want to do it, a fair amount, like a small handful of fennel seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to crush those. And then you're going to add to that, are you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
You are going to add to that lots of black pepper, the zest of oranges and lemons, and garlic, and some candied citron, if you can get your hands on it.
Wow.
Yeah. And you're going to stuff that into the slits. I mean, those slits have got to be burgeoning with this stuff.
Mm.
And rub it over the lamb and stick it in the fridge overnight.
Overnight in the fridge.
Right. Then do a slow roast, like 325 degrees. Because it's a big hunk of meat,
right? Right.
And you want to keep it kind of pink inside. And you want to baste it with a combination of a good wine vinegar, about one part wine vinegar to three parts red wine.
Okay.
And, oh, you know what I'd do?
Mm-hmm.
I would put it in the roasting pan on a bed of thick orange slices.
Ooh.
And lots of garlic, okay? And maybe some fennel, if you got fresh fennel around.
Okay.
All right? And onion slices.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like a rack of this stuff, because that's also going to make a great sauce.
Yes,
it's going to all add up. So you keep basting it with its pan juices and with a little combination of the vinegar and the wine, because you want this tart, sweet, savory stuff. And then when you get it all done, you make a pan sauce, okay,
mm-hmm.
adding some more wine and broth and boil that down. And then you arrange the lamb. And then if you really want it, you know, you want to do this the way they did it back in the days of Lucrezia and all her pals and buddies, you could have made little pastries that you filled with chopped salami and fig, like little turnovers, and you would garnish the plate with those, and you'd put it on a bed of sliced oranges and greens.
And do you have a wine to recommend?
I would say with this you want something like an Amarone,
mm-hmm.
something that really has a lot of oomph to it, and this, I don't know if this is summer food, you may want to hold off.
Well, our summer is very, very short, 2 or 3 days, it seems.
Oh, all right. So there you go. I mean, just wait 2 or 3 days and you've got a party. Hey, Kathleen, have a great time.
Well, God bless you, and enjoy the Renaissance if there's a festival in your area.
Thank you, ma'am. I shall. And you enjoy the lamb.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Paul is calling. Paul, hi. What's up?
Lynn, boy, I'll tell you, that sounds so good. I'm starved now.
That's the whole idea, Paul.
Yeah,
the whole idea. If we don't make you hungry, we have failed.
I have a little problem, and my fiance and I just planted a big garden in our backyard, and we've got clay soil. And so she said, well, we ought to plant some icicle radishes to dig up the clay and make it softer. And now we've got tons and tons of these icicle radishes. And there's got to be something we can do with icicle radishes besides put them in the compost bin.
Now, what is an icicle radish?
It's a white radish that looks like a carrot.
Oh, it's a long radish. Okay, I get you. Instead of those little balls.
Right. You know, the red ones I know what to do with. You just chomp on them.
But how do the icicles taste? What does it taste like?
Almost like horseradish.
Real strong, then.
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
And they're mealy.
I've got an idea.
So you take a bite out of it, it gives you something to chew for a month and a half.
Does not sound like you're insane about these things.
Pardon me?
It does not sound like you are insane about these things.
No, no. And we said, well, if anybody knows what to do with it, give LRC a call.
Hey.
So what do we do with these doggone things?
All right. Okay, guess what?
What?
I think I've got an idea, believe it or not. Two things come to mind. The first thing is sautéed radishes.
Okay.
And nobody ever cooks radishes, and I think this is a real oversight. Just literally, you know, you can cut them up into bite-sized pieces if you want. You know, wash them, dry them, sauté them with butter, because the sweetness of the butter against the heat of the radish is really good. And I would throw a big handful of chopped up scallions and salt and pepper into the sauté, and you cook them maybe 4 minutes, 5 minutes max, and eat them hot. But
okay.
There's a better idea. This is a takeoff on a Belgian classic bar snack. When you go to the beer halls in Belgium, the bars all serve beer. And the Belgians, you know, make 300-some-odd kinds of beer. This is a favorite snack that you get. You take a coarse grain multigrain bread, you know, a real rustic country bread. you know, the kind that you have to really chew.
Mm-hmm.
And you take some really good cream cheese and mix up diced onion into the cream cheese along with salt and pepper. Now, right there, if you stop right there, the cream cheese is really tasty. Spread that cream cheese on a slice of the bread and then slice your radishes and put them on top and sprinkle them with coarse salt. And trust me, radishes cream cheese sandwiches are really great because the creaminess of the cream cheese with that little bit of onion cuts through the heat of the radish. And that should work for you.
Thank you very much.
Does that sound like it'll work?
Pardon me?
Does it sound like it'll work?
I think it'll work perfectly.
Okay, and the thing is, since you have so many of them, invite over all your friends and show them how to do do-it-yourself sandwiches and have a sandwich party.
We could invite over the planet.
Yeah, but you no longer have soil that's solid like a rock, right?
That's what she keeps saying.
Well, just, you know, she's right. Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye, Paul.
Bye.
I've got another use for cream cheese, by the way. I just came up with this a couple of weeks ago. We had beautiful white peaches, and I wanted to make a real simple fruit tart. So I made a crust, a sweet crust, and I baked it. And I didn't want to make a cooked filling. So I took a pound of cream cheese, threw it in the food processor. Now don't anybody call for this recipe, guys. You're going to have to get a grip here. You're going to improvise, all right? You're going to use sugar to taste. And for a pound of cream cheese, about the grated zest of one whole lemon and the juice of almost a whole lemon and a pinch of salt. And you just whip that around in the food processor, okay? Set it aside and then whip cream with vanilla and sugar to taste. Then fold the two of them together. Put them in the fridge if you can overnight because this stuff ripens. It tastes like cheesecake by the next day. And then all you do is spread it like frosting over the bottom of your tart shell, which you've already cooked, okay, and then slice your fruit on top of it. We did it with white peaches. Let me tell you, the only word to describe this was sexy. This was really good. So, there you go. A no-cook filling, just heavy whipped cream and cream cheese. A little cholesterol for everybody. Happy summer. We came across some interesting information. It seems the Monterey Bay Aquarium in Monterey Bay in California has set up something called a seafood watch. It's a guide for consumers. And we wanted to learn more about this. So we got Stephen Webster on the line. Stephen is a co-founder of this program. Stephen, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Glad to be here.
Stephen, what in heaven's name is an aquarium doing with a seafood watch for eaters?
The program initially grew out of our need to provide information to our visitors, both for what we feed the fish and for what we feed our visitors in our restaurant. Lots of folks ask the question, well, gee, what's okay for me to serve or to order at a restaurant, and what should I be concerned about?
So you've actually made a set of lists of seafood that we should avoid, seafood that's okay, based on what you feel might be endangered?
That's correct, Lynn, and it isn't just what we feel might be endangered. We research these stocks pretty thoroughly. And because lots and lots of the seafoods now being served in this country and many places around the world come from far and distant places, it's not good enough just to look in your own backyard. And mm-hmm. So we really consult with fisheries biologists and with the governmental organizations in Australia, New Zealand, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, as well as our own National Marine Fisheries Service.
Well, let's get to that list. I mean, what are some of the things that we should avoid?
Sharks should be avoided, and that's an interesting one because they're taken not only for meat, they are taken for their fins, for shark fin soup, which is a high-end item at Chinese restaurants in this country as well as in China. And shark populations around the world are very often in trouble because they're slow to grow, they're slow to mature, and they aren't very fecund. They don't produce very many offspring each year. I was asked the other day, well, how about Preparation H? It has shark liver oil in it. And that's another example. Whether it's a pharmaceutical product or for the dinner table, sharks are in trouble. So we should probably avoid sharks virtually anywhere.
What else?
Farmed salmon is an interesting one. Folks ordinarily would think, well, gee, if they're farmed, doesn't that take the pressure off wild populations? In some ways it does, but here are some of the problems. Farmed salmon in British Columbia are typically Atlantic salmon from a different ocean. They're grown in pens, and there are often escapees. It's now thought there are over a quarter of a million escaped Atlantic salmon in British Columbia, and they're even beginning to breed up there. So then there's the introduced species question, as well as disease problems, growing them in tight quarters like that, which means they often use antibiotics in the feed.
Huh.
There is more salmon sewage produced each year under those salmon pens than the city of San Francisco produces in a year. And of course, it's untreated. And because the pens are grown in quiet water places, that sewage building up on the bottom doesn't get processed very readily. And finally, what do you feed a salmon? You feed it a fish meal based largely on fish. And so it takes about 5 pounds of wild fish to produce 1 pound of farmed salmon. That's why we have wild-caught Alaska salmon and California salmon in the best choices area. We're hoping that rather than just using these lists like ours or Audubon's or Environmental Defense, rather than just taking our word for it, get to asking the right set of questions from your restaurateur or your fish seller. Where did the fish come from? Are you sure it's a sustainable fishery that's environmentally responsible? And in the case of aquaculture, where did it come from, and how environmentally responsible are those farms? Farmed shrimp is another example. Again, they use fish meal to feed the shrimp, and many of them are areas in the tropics where coastal mangroves have been dredged and filled to form the ponds, and so you are adversely affecting the natural habitat that is producing the larvae for the wild shrimp in those areas.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Stephen Webster is co-founder of the Seafood Watch program at California's Monterey Bay Aquarium. You can get information on Seafood Watch on our website at splendidtable.org. And be sure to check their site regularly because it's constantly being updated. Well, that's the show for today, folks. I want to thank everybody for joining us. Have a great week. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with a Chinese proverb. When walking through a melon patch, don't adjust your sandals. Think about that. Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials, 1810 stainless steel cookware from Calphalon. It's professional style heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. Information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. The associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our intern is Phoebe Larson. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bakely Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Radio International.